Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Robert Kumaki, principal of the Ronin Group and author of Many Cultures, One Market, A Guide to Understanding Opportunities in the Asian Pacific American Market. He'll speak on the topic Marketing to Asian America 3.0. This program, sponsored by the Asian World Center and the Hyder College of Business, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, November 30th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Trent Wachner, Associate Professor in the Hyder College of Business at Creighton University.
Mr. Kumaki is an author of the book Many Cultures, One Market. He is an adjunct professor at several universities, including University of Illinois. He has an esteemed marketing background, which I'm thrilled about because of being a marketing professor. He's worked at some of the biggest companies, including Young & Rubicon and Ogilvy & Mather. He currently has his own business, which he's owned for 10 years, and does global marketing, specifically helping companies that are looking to come from Asian markets to the U.S., and understanding the complexity of the Asian American consumer. So one of the things that I pulled from his website that I thought was interesting, he just had some statistics on his website to understand Asian Americans. He said that Asian Americans are 4% of the population, yet they're 8% of seafood sales. And then they're also 20% of the freshman class at the top universities across the country. So it's a very multidimensional demographic, and for him to tell us about this, we'd like to introduce Mr. Kumaki. Thank you.
Thanks, Trent. I'm a marketing guy and an Asian American, and those two things don't necessarily go together. What I always told my clients is that no matter how much you know about demographics or consumption habits or pricing models, you cannot separate culture from marketing. You cannot do one without the other. You can't do it effectively. The title of my talk today is Marketing to Asian America 3.0. And, of course, this always begs the question, what happened to Asian America 1.0 and 2.0? Well, let's start with Asian America 1.0. At the beginning, here it is, Asian America 1.0 in marketing terms. That was it. There was no marketing to Asian Americans in 1.0. For most of the 20th century, and even today, there's no creative inclusion, there was no media planning, it wasn't even on the radar in terms of any kind of consideration for a market. So you ask yourself, why is this the case? These are some of the actual statements that I've heard from Fortune 500 companies, some of the biggest companies in the entire world. People have told me the absolute size of the market is too small. There are too many languages to deal with. They don't need any attention. They're the model minority. Or inversely, aren't they all immigrants? You know, we already reached them. They're all assimilated already. African Americans and Hispanics are much more important to us. We don't have any set aside money. And on and on and on. And the best one I say for last, someone actually told me there aren't any Asian Americans living around here. So why should we talk to them? But given thinking like this, it's no wonder that many companies feel it's okay to ignore a 17 million person, $1 trillion market. But given there's at least some interest, let's take a look at Asian America 2.0. I'm sure most of you are at least a little bit familiar with some of these images. You know, we have Astro Boy in the top corner there. The infamous Long Duck Dong in the bottom right, and you know my guy Bruce Lee in the top. What's happened is that most of America are more familiar with these images than they are with most Asian Americans, and we're going to go into that in a little bit. Asian America 2.0 really came into being because corporate America's heart was in the right place. They want to reach out to Asian Americans, but its head was not in the right place. And marketing needs to be head-driven, not heart-driven. So the problem is those stereotype images are what shaped the way America thought about these people. So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is corporate America was living under the old paradigm. First, they spoke in terms of Asians, not Asian Americans. And we're going to get into that in a little bit, discuss the distinction. Second, in most companies, the person handling ethnic marketing handled all targets apart from the general market. So for a host of reasons, marketing to Asian Americans is different than marketing to other ethnic groups. Not better, not more cost efficient, not more cost effective, just different. Just as you would not have the same marketing program to teenage boys that you would to soccer moms, it doesn't make sense to assume all ethnic markets are going to behave in the same way. Now, on one hand, you have people from the general market who, with little or no knowledge of ethnic markets to begin with, give you their list of rules. You know, if we're going to create a commercial, if we're going to create a piece of communication, if we're going to create a package, they have to have this color, and they have to have this symbol, and they have this kind of cultural iconography. On the other hand, you have people that say, well, I'm Chinese or Korean or Filipino, so that makes me a Chinese or Korean or Filipino marketing expert. Both are incorrect. You know, on one hand, the first is too simplistic. It might have worked in the 1950s. It doesn't work at all anymore. Secondly, these ethnically born marketing experts, I tell them, marketing is not genetic. It is a discipline that you have to learn. You're not born with it. Unfortunately, a lot of people say, well, I can get away with it because of the way I look. And that's one of the reasons why ethnic marketing in this country is still pretty screwed up. Now, in the last 10 years, you would never see an African-American in a TV commercial, for example, in a minstrel show. You would never see an Hispanic-American riding a donkey. It's still okay to see images of Asian-American stereotypes. The last couple of pictures that we saw in commercial communications, and we're going to get into that a little bit as well. So what's the modern-day outcome of Asian American 2.0? People said, we can just use Asian culture and they eliminate the need for any Asian images at all. Now, these are all from movies that are either just out or going to be out very soon. You might recognize the not-very-Tibetan Tilda Swinton, who's portraying the Ancient One in Marvel Comics' Doctor Strange. The very Japanese Scarlett Johansson, who is portraying Major Kusanagi in Ghost in the Shell. We have Noah Ringer as the Last Airbender. And Matt Damon, who single-handedly saved all of China in the movie The Great Wall. So let's get over that. Let's finally get to Asian America 3.0. But we need to set a few guidelines first. So first of all, what is different about Asian Americans? First of all, the separate but equal philosophy doesn't apply. Because of Asian background, most Asian Americans prefer inclusive culture rather than exclusive culture approach to communication. They like to be part of a group, not a separate entity. Second, ethnic marketing began in this country in the 1960s, and it grew out of the civil rights movement. And because of that, the social causes that built African American and Hispanic marketing, education, housing, jobs, things of that nature, do not exist in the same way for most Asian Americans. You know, as Michael Corleone would say in The Godfather, this is about business. This is not about social services. This is not about civil rights. Even though that grew, that segment as a part of the marketing landscape, not the same thing. Third, Asian Americans generally are not included in the discussion in America about race. Could be a lot of reasons. Could be because of length of history. Could be because there is no charismatic leader in the Asian American community. There is no Jesse Jackson. There is no Al Sharpton to kind of lead the charge. When there's an issue about Asian Americans that come up, who do we call on the phone? Who's going to give us the soundbite? There is no such person, at least not one who is recognizable enough to be that person. Now, this exclusion from race discussion until very recently was a symptom of almost complete media invisibility. Now you can see John Cho and Mindy Kaling and Daniel Day-Kim and Aziz Ansari and Constance Wu, and everybody's favorite and king of the internet, my favorite, George Takei, all over. They're very visible in terms of where they are and how you see them in media. But up until the last decade, media invisibility was almost complete. Most of you are not old enough to remember an old show called Bonanza, But there was a character on Bonanza called Hop Singh, and he was pretty much the only Asian character on TV during most of the 1950s and 60s. The old Hawaii Five-O show, not the new one, the old one, had two kind of bit players who were Asian American. There used to be a show called The Streets of San Francisco that had zero Asian characters, not as principals, not even on the street. In San Francisco, a city that is almost 40% Asian, none, did not see them. You saw the hills, just didn't see any Asian people. Now, lastly, and something we're going to go into more depth, is the assimilation of Asians into American society. It's an unstoppable train. Generally, within one generation, Asians coming to America lose language facility from their home country almost immediately, within one generation. That's almost unheard of. This is significantly different, for example, from the Hispanic marketplace, in that it's not unusual to find a fifth-generation Mexican-American who still speaks Spanish as their principal language. With most Asian American groups, and that's true across Chinese, Korean, Japanese, Filipino, what have you, within one generation, it's gone. The food stays, the language goes. Now, one of the things we have to get used to thinking about, and I was talking about this a little bit earlier with one of my colleagues, is there's a shift in American culture. We need to help America understand the movement from a purely Northern European to a more international culture. You know, some politicians still pine for a real America, the global shift away from this American Eurocentric kind of positioning is just increasing. And the international axes that can't be ignored, what we call the Latin axis, the North-South, mainly in North and South America, and the East-West axis between the U.S. primarily and Asia, for economics, for culture, for immigration and politics, is going to continue to increase, particularly once all the dust from the recent election settles down. I think we'll see it's just not going to go away. Now, before you can discuss Asian Americans, you need to know a little bit something about Asia. Unless there is a disaster like earthquakes in Japan or toxic lead paint on toys from China or something called Gangnam Style, which hopefully most of you have heard of because it got 2 billion hits on YouTube, most Americans, even African Americans and Hispanic Americans, have a very Eurocentric kind of view of America. Chances are you touch something made in Asia or in Asian origin every single day. You might not know about it, but you do. It's really just not top of mind unless it's newsworthy. So even as Asian and Asian Americans need to be thought of as two separate groups, there's a considerable amount of cultural overlap that we need to take into account. The problem is there are challenges to this global view. There are challenges to understanding Asia and Asian Americans, much less a total global view. Now, the U.S. Department of Education, National Geographic, and Roper polled high school students, and here's what they found. Less than 30% feel it's important to study a foreign language. 47% cannot find India on a map. 60% did not know that the north-south border between Korea is the most heavily fortified in the world. 74% think English is the most commonly spoken native language. 45% think China is only 2 times the population of the U.S. And on and on and on. The real one that really hit me is that given this global map, given this shift from North America at the center to a more global kind of view, less than 1% of high school students study Arabic, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Russian, or Urdu combined. Combined. So just by viewing language studies and geography, you can see why so many Americans and thus American marketers have a tough time shifting from one view of the world, a U.S.-centered view, to a more global one. Now, it should be noted that less than a third of Americans possess a passport, and thus most will never experience another culture in the home setting. So, how do we get started with all this? Let's start looking at this issue where it hits most America closest to home, in the pocketbook. And this really is the way we should start all marketing. Now, marketers subscribe to the fundamental principles rather than social pressures will nearly always focus on these customers most likely to be able to buy their product. Now, if you look at some of these figures, U.S. population versus buying power, it's difficult to understand why Asian Americans have been ignored so long. There are about 16 million Asian Americans in this country, with a buying power of just under $1 trillion. Compare this to the African American and Hispanic populations, and you can see the per capita income is dramatically different, dramatically different. Now, some people have challenged this number. No, it's really 1.1 trillion. No, it's 1.6 trillion. That part doesn't matter. Directionally, if you look at ethnic marketing, the per capita income is really the important part. It's this concentration of wealth that many overlook in favor of population and also in favor of social services and civil rights we talked about already. Now, while Hispanic marketing is fueled by size, Asian American marketing is fueled by wealth. Now, Trent mentioned earlier some other statistics. It's up to 5% of the population now from 4%. It is still about 8% of seafood sales and still over 20% of incoming class at top universities. I don't know how it is here at Creighton, but certainly if you look at schools on the West Coast, that's an issue. They've actually – some schools have had many discussions about caps on the number of Asian American students allowed in certain schools at Ivy Leagues, West Coast schools, other schools that have a high propensity to attract Asian American students. Now, if you start adding all this stuff together, you know, there's ethnic marketing, there's all this information, there's all these conflicting opinions. What we come to is the fact that every discussion I've ever heard about Asian American marketing includes the word complex. I defy anyone to find a discussion about it, except my stuff, that doesn't have the word complex in it. Virtually every marketer I've ever worked with has said the same thing. This market's too complex. Some of those things that people said earlier, too many languages, too many different groups, too much different history, too complex. So instead of diving deep into the marketplace, instead of understanding the target, instead of getting a good description of the demographics and the psychographics, doing a real ethnography, people have said, nope, too complex, just not going to do it. So really, from a fundamental viewpoint, let's look at what marketing is. I mean, the classic definition, all of you probably already know, it's a business function that's concerned with product, price, promotion, distribution. I always add people because, unfortunately, that's the most forgotten and least understood area of the discipline. I know a lot of people who are experts in pricing models couldn't tell you a single thing about the description of their target market. And that's where my company and I always start with. Who are we talking to? How are we talking to them and why? So we start talking about ethnic marketing specifically. Now, race makes people do goofy things. It makes them kind of ignore basic principles and logic in favor of emotion. And that's what I try to tell my clients. You need to step back. You need to go back to basic fundamental issues of good business practices and kind of weave it all together. Don't just throw that out in favor of whatever emotional kind of reaction you might have. Now, most marketers are still working from a 1960s model in that they would have you believe, or they believe themselves, that ethnic markets, first of all, are homogeneous. Never were, never will be. None are. If you look at the Hispanic marketplace, African-American marketplace, none of them are. But the smart marketer can understand the propensity to react like a mass and sense our business is getting masses of people to buy our product, to buy our services, to cast their vote. Whatever we want them to do, we need bunches of people to do it. It's not an individual kind of effort. Secondly, compare with the 1950s approach to immigration and becoming, quote-unquote, American, assimilation is not zero-sum. We're going to get to this in just a little bit more depth. The mistake that many marketers make is that with many ethnic programs, they try to communicate in language but not in culture. For example, the average Cuban-American will tell you there are very few cultural similarities with a Mexican-American or a Guatemalan-American or a Salvadorian American beyond speaking Spanish, and perhaps not even that, because even within that group, the Spanish is significantly different. When I consulted with Sears Roebuck years and years ago, their definition of an Hispanic-based store was any store which had 5% or more of the population speaking Spanish in a 15-mile radius. That is every major city in the United States. So by their own definition, every single store in the United States in every major city was an Hispanic-based store. And you ask yourself, does that make any sense? The answer is no. So planning for an ethnic target, just like any other target, we start at the beginning. And this is what I mean by getting a seat at the grown-ups table. You have to start planning from the beginning. Procter & Gamble, the largest advertiser in the world, used to have a program whereby they set aside 2% of their marketing budget specifically for African-American efforts for every brand that's over, I believe it was $2 billion in sales. It didn't matter if the African-American target wanted the product, if they wanted Pampers or Bounty or Charmin or any of those products. It was just an automatic set-aside. So this is one of the things that I questioned with them when I was working with them, in that, is this marketing or is this social causes? And my relationship with them didn't last very long after that because of bringing up things like that. It was a pure set-aside reaction. Finally, people tell us there's no way to measure. You know, there's an old advertising adage that said, you know, I know half of my money is being wasted. I just don't know which half. Same thing happens here in that people have told me, we can't measure this marketplace. We don't know how to do it. And I respond to them, that's just kind of lazy on your part because there are many ways to do it now. Didn't happen in the 50s, but certainly does happen now. So starting from our target, these are things that most marketers can understand, demographics. Generally, and you know, most of you probably know this already, Asian Americans tend to be younger, upscale, white-collar, educated. Marketers have been agreeing with this for years. They said, oh yeah, ideal target. They have all these kinds of things. So my response is, why aren't you marketing towards them? But here's a twist. A couple of things are changing in this new century. And first of all, the geographic diversity is increasing. Chinatowns, the place of first landing, the ethnic ghetto are much, much less important than it was when I was born. We're seeing these things we call immigration frontiers. Johns Creek, Georgia is a heavily Asian American town. And you go, Johns Creek, Georgia, why is anybody living there? Because there's a technology park there. Cary, North Carolina, it's like, Asian Americans don't live in North Carolina. Yes, they do. SAS, the statistical company, is based in Cary, North Carolina. Parts of Southeast Texas. Texas is home to a huge Asian American population, much of it because of the shrimp industry, much of it because of people from Southeast Asia. The other thing we're seeing happen is a true pan-Asian culture that's emerging. It's an intra-ethnic coalition with common strategies for success. Remember, the term Asian is an American construct. If you go to Asia, no one there is going to say, I'm Asian. They're going to say, I'm Chinese, or I'm Korean, or I'm Filipino, or I'm Vietnamese, or whatever. Nobody says they're Asian. People in America, Asian Americans here, say, yes, I'm Asian. We're going to get into this a little bit later as well. Finally, there are biological shifts that will really drive attitudinal shift. Does anybody know what the term Hapa means? It means half. Generally, historically, it's been half Asian, half white. In fact, very specifically, it's been half Japanese, half white. Now it's been, and that was used as a very pejorative kind of term. Now, actually, it's a point of pride with a lot of people to be half Asian, half someone else. The funny thing is, and we predicted this quite a while ago, is that of all Asian American subgroups, so Chinese American, Korean American, Japanese American, what have you, the largest subgroup is soon going to be those who are only part Asian or a mix of Asian nationalities. This has never happened before in the history of the world, not just United States, the world. There is no Hapa land where these people come from. They got here and they married and met other people from different ethnic groups. This is a new idea that marketers have to understand. So all this background stuff, people still tell me, I still don't know what to do with it. It's still way too complex. There's too much brain stuff going on. Help me out. So what we do is we help them understand the new paradigm. This is finally getting to Asian America 3.0. The first is that the understanding that Asian American groups are no more complex and no more mysterious and no more unreachable than any other group. You know, are Asian Americans more difficult to understand than Hispanic Americans or even soccer moms? We say no. It is a target market just like any other. To claim that it's more difficult or more complex or more unreachable is just it's laziness or prejudice or unwillingness to use basic and fundamental principles to understand the marketplace. Now, as marketing students, many of you already know what all these are. And so hopefully none of this is going to be a surprise to you when it's laid out in this kind of format. So let's look at three basic parts to understand, communicate with, and reach the Asian American consumer and Asian America 3.0. First is what we call the Americanization dynamic. We recognize there are generational imprints that drive attitudes that are based partly on age. Good parallels understanding the difference between baby boomers and millennials, but based on immigration status. Different Asian ethnic groups came here at different times. The bulk of Japanese Americans tended to come here in the very early 1900s. Most Southeast Asians came directly after the Vietnam War. Koreans came in two waves in the 1950s and the 1970s. So different time periods for different people coming over that have affected their experience in the U.S. The Chinese have been in the U.S. for over two centuries with intermittent, you know, immigration. So it depends when they came, each with a differing view where they belong and how they relate to the country. But we find that with successive generations, these kind of things go away. And that's one of the bases for understanding Asian Americans as an Asian American group. Second, with the exception of many Southeast Asians, almost with the exception of students, everyone came here to be American. Whether they were looking for a better life, whether they were starving in the old country, whether they're evading a war, they came here specifically to be an American. Very few Asians came here with the intent, I'm going to come to the U.S., I'm going to stay here 3 years, I'm going to become a millionaire, I'm going back to the home country. That's a common kind of romantic view of immigration, but immigration tends not to work like that. Most people that have come here tended to stay here. Now, my research partner has coined the term Asian American escalator. You know, we talk about the term elevator, but I don't like elevator because an elevator, you can go up, you can go down, you can get off on any floor you want. Asian Americans tend to get on at the bottom, and they tend not to get off until they reach the top. The Asian American focus has always been on building a better life for themselves, for their families, and they tend to use common strategies that cross national and ethnic lines. It's basically a Confucian kind of plan in that you work hard, you educate your kids, you plan for success. Does this play into the whole, you know, some of you might have heard of the model minority myth? Yeah, it does, to some extent. But as with every myth, there is at least a little bit of basic in fact. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about the assimilation not being zero sum. When my parents' generation was growing up, the whole idea is no matter where you were from, this was true with people from Asia, people from Europe, people from South America, people from wherever, you had to be 100% American. And that meant erasing a lot of things. Naturally, everybody spoke English, but it also meant giving up a lot of cultural practices, a lot of family traditions, things like that. What we find is that today you can be 100% American and still maintain all of your ethnic traditions. I mean, the very least of which is on St. Patrick's Day when somebody who looks like me wears a button that says, "Kiss me, I'm Irish." You can still do that. It doesn't fit, but it still works. Now, I gave a speech a while ago at a senior center when someone in the audience said, "Yeah, but that's just the American dream." And I said, "Yeah, you're exactly right." And that's what they came here for. Now, this one is something we call the own race effect. If any of you have studied any neuroscience or any biology or anything like that, you're going to know that human beings are hardwired in the brain, they're born with this, to recognize people who look like them. There's a biological imperative because babies need to recognize their mother. Okay, so they need to recognize people look like them. This is from neuroscience. Lawyers do this, actually, when they're picking juries. It's even been shown in baseball umpires. There's an affinity for different groups based on race. But for some reason, it's been ignored in the marketing world. And perhaps it's because too much ethnic marketing has been based on stereotypes and all the cultural baggage that goes along with it. This phenomenon is just now being understood by marketers in that diversity in casting for a TV commercial, for example, actually has a positive effect, particularly for Asian Americans who have been outside of the media, both commercial media and the entertainment world, for most of the last century. Now, we'd never claim that all Asians look alike, even though some people still claim that. But the research shows there's a definite recognition and affinity for seeing faces that look at least marginally like your own. We've had many people say, well, that guy's Japanese. He's not Chinese. They said, yeah, you're right. But if you look at the overall population, the affinity for seeing someone who looks at least a little bit like them is still very, very strong. And finally, we come to the most debatable, most debated, but in my mind, undebatable point of all. The common denominator, and that's English. The 2.0 model would have you cut up the Asian American market into a minimum of 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 segments, each with their own language. You remember those genetic marketers I told you about? They profit from being translators, not from being marketers. If we're going to amass a group big enough for most marketing companies to reach, we need to get the biggest group of people that we possibly can. And we recognize English as one of the strongest common denominators, just as Spanish is used in the Hispanic marketplace. Now, many people will say that's not true. They don't buy into it. What I tell them is throw out my research, throw out my company's research, throw out all the groups we worked with before. Look instead at the U.S. Census. Look instead at the General Social Survey and other widely available published government sources. The most commonly spoken language among Asian Americans in the U.S. is English, 88%. The most commonly spoken, next commonly spoken language in the U.S. is Mandarin at 12%. So if you are a marketer trying to maximize your return on investment in communication materials, do you want 88% or do you want 12%? Now, speaking more than one language, and this is where people get a little bit confused, speaking more than one language does not negate or even predict English language facility. A good example of this is the fact that, you know, if the majority of Asian Americans have college degrees, that makes a sense for speaking English. It's not possible to graduate college in this country without speaking English. Once people get their head wrapped around that, it's a little bit easier for them to understand. Now, one of the things we do is people tell us, even with that concentrated wealth, even with that $1 trillion of buying power, still only, you know, 5, 6, 7 million people. You know, how are we going to get more than that? One of the things we find out with Asian American marketing is we have what are called cultural gateways. It's a huge bonus. One of the bonuses that we see is that no matter what type of Asian-based cultural activity there is, whether it's flower arranging or martial arts or language classes or anything like that, the bulk of the people in the U.S. involved in those activities are not Asian American. They have joined these activities and events and cultural groups specifically because their own type of interest. Feng Shui is a great... Does everybody know what Feng Shui is? The whole understanding of arranging your house and pictures on the wall to channel energy and find balance and such. I defy any of you to go to a bookstore and find a book on Feng Shui written by a Chinese person. You are not going to find one. You know, consider the fact that there are more Chinese restaurants in the United States than all of the McDonald's, Burger King's, and Wendy's combined. That's a staggering number. There's an author named Jennifer Lee who wrote a book called The Fortune Cookie Chronicles. And one of my favorite pieces in there is she says, you think about the quintessential American food as apple pie. Mom, Chevrolet, and apple pie. The question you've got to ask yourself is, how many times a year do you eat apple pie? Maybe Thanksgiving, maybe Christmas, maybe a couple other times a year. Now ask yourself, how many times a year do you eat Chinese food? So which is more American? Don't know. That's tough to say. So we have an idea now. We have an understanding of this whole Americanization dynamic. People are here to be in America. We have an understanding of this own race effect. There's a connection somehow just seeing visuals of people who look sort of like other Asian Americans. And you have English as a common language to communicate with. So what do? We need to apply this. And we start with strategy, first of all. Is there a business insight for doing this? Is there a reason why we should even be talking to these people? Is there a reason why that, you know, we don't need to set aside money for this group? Is there a recognition of needs and wants for and by the consumer? Is there a connection between your brand essence and what they want to get out of the product? Next, and as my accounting students always tell me, is there a profit motive? Are we going to make money off of this target marketplace? Or is this just social cause marketing? Is this worthy of attention? Now remember, this is a business. It's not civil rights, even though the two are not mutually exclusive. And finally, all these principles need to apply in creative and media decisions. I'm going to go a little bit off track here because most of my background is in ad agency, so I tend to think kind of in those directions. With creative executions, one of the first things we find out, and this is true really of every single target audience that you want, is that you want to make an invitation to buy. It's very different from saying, okay, we don't care if you buy our product, to saying, we want you to buy our product. That invitation is a key and critical difference that many people avoid. Now, one of the things that people say about their research tells us about the own race effect is that sometimes any Asian face will do. You know, the Chinese cultural experts, the Korean cultural experts, the Filipino cultural experts say, no, it must be one ethnic group. Our research tells us otherwise. Now, as you get out into the business world and start doing this kind of thing on your own, I'm not saying buy into everything I say. I'm saying look at the research. Always look at the research. Now, today, most people would not be surprised at all to see an African-American actor selling almost any product on TV. Almost any product. What Asian America 3.0 suggests is that smart marketers who skip Asian America 2.0 and go right to 3.0, there really wasn't a time when Asian Americans demanded to see Asian American faces. I don't know if any of you heard of a network called BET, Black Entertainment Television, but there is a rule in their corporate structure whereby if you have a commercial that shows on BET, it must have an African American principal in the TV commercial itself. While we understand that those kind of rules don't apply all over, the cultural cues that people build into communications, the things we saw in the 1960s with Asian Americans, people dressed in national dress or showing pictures of red lanterns or Chinese restaurants, is really just not necessary. Just like it's not necessary anymore to identify African Americans by showing them in a gospel church or in a marching band or things like that that were very, very prevalent in the 60s and 70s. So in Asian America 3.0, there's really a couple of common strategies. First, Asian Americans use the extras. And this is the most, this is what we call the natural order kind of strategy, in that they're just people like anybody else. You stick them in the commercial, stick in avoiding what we call the rainbow coalition of an ad, where you see a Caucasian person, Hispanic person, African American, an Asian American person, a disabled person. I tend not to like those kinds of communications. Make me very nervous because I think, well, this is kind of pandering, you know, to your audience. Second, we see them as principals in communications, often as a mixed race couple. Typically with an Asian American woman and a Caucasian man. Now, this does two things. It is a reflection of reality. It also plays a little bit into some sort of weird fetish thing going on, but I don't fault marketers necessarily for doing that. And lastly, there do exist specific reasons for targeting groups specifically. And many of these have to do with biological need, in that Asian Americans tend to be more susceptible to things like diabetes, osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease. But this is a very specific health care kind of issues, and not a general market kind of conversations. So when we're choosing where to show these commercials, where to communicate, what to discuss with our target audience, you know, again, we have two scenarios. One is mass media as part of the general order. And honestly, this type of communication is extremely measurable. You know, people say, we can't measure our audience. We don't know who we're talking to. This is very measurable. The advertising world in the past decade has been in a frenzy trying to figure out, what do we do with digital media? How do we do anything with it? That is the most measurable of all media. And it's just becoming one of the major communication vehicles, along with TV, radio, print, outdoor, and such. Now, separately, there's an interesting thing going on. Since many Asian Americans have been ignored for so long in traditional media, many have turned to internet channels, such as YouTube, Instagram. You know, are all you familiar with YouTube and Instagram? Probably a lot of you post on Instagram and Snapchat and such. Not only to view, but to post their own content, which, again, has never been happened before. You ever heard of a group called 88 Rising? You know, Asian American audience tend to be a little higher in that regard. Entertainer Nicky Limo, who has 475,000 subscribers. A channel called Off the Great Wall that has 600,000 subscribers. Group called Just Kidding News with 1.6 million subscribers. And my personal favorite, there's a guy who's a competitive eater named Matt Stoney, who has 2.2 million subscribers. There is not a media company in this world who would not love to have those kinds of numbers. So, is there anybody actually doing it? Yes, there are. Again, because of the way Asian America 3.0 needs to be looked at, its difficulty of communications is specifically trying to target a group, or if it's including them as part of the casting and part of this natural order of the world. It's even difficult to say, you know, how audiences are reacting to it in that way. But some of the people up here are doing an exceptional job, not only of being inclusive, but getting a great reaction from their audience. Asian Americans are saying, wow, we saw ourselves in your spot, and guess what? We are going to buy your product. We are going to buy your service. We are going to have an affinity for your company over others who we do not see ourselves in, who are not talking to us, who do not understand us as a target market. Not surprisingly, the heaviest areas in finance and tech and automotive. The surprise are people like Kohl's, who want to reach a very broad audience but have included a very, very enlightened kind of understanding of who different target audiences in the U.S. are. And lastly, there's some thoughts. Because most of you are marketing students, I'm not going to leave you with conclusions. You need to form those on your own. Instead, I want to leave you some final thoughts. There's a constant state of evolutionary marketing. The challenge is not a conventional ethnic model, in this case, I mean, we've talked about the past hour or so, but an understanding that you have an audience that is not different from any other, in that it can be reached, it can be understood, it can be figured out a way for businesses to make money against this target market. But you still have to use those fundamental concepts, those fundamental understandings, getting beyond simple translations. So always check credentials of the people that you're working with. You apply these fundamental marketing principles to maximize your return on investment, because that's what every business in America is geared around. And if you use what we call the new paradigm for marketing success, the Americanization dynamic, the Owen Race effect, English as a common denominator, can't guarantee that it's going to work, but for the clients we've worked with, it's an enlightened kind of process, and it seemed to work for them. Now, hopefully, in the last hour, by the time we get to here, you're thinking, well, yeah, that's kind of all obvious stuff. It's simple. It's all practical. just as with what I do with my clients, I say, well, an hour ago, is that what you thought? And for the most part, I would say no. But hopefully, you know, you're getting along to that point now. So open up for any questions, any comments, any new ideas, any thoughts on, Bob, you don't know what you're talking about, but we're here anyway. But happy to answer any questions.
Earlier you talked about how they come here for the American dream just like anybody else did. But in terms of that, like, difference per capita in buying power, is there something specific about Asian Americans and their culture or their motivations that help them get that much more than everybody else in terms of coming here looking for opportunity?
That's one of the areas for the greatest debate in this whole subject. The Asian American population is very bimodal. You know, that's why people call the whole model minority myth. You know, they're all successful and all educated. You have people on one end, typically Chinese Americans, Korean Americans, Indian Americans, Japanese Americans, who have been in this country for a fairly long time and very successful. What that tends to do is mask the problems that many Southeast Asians, people from Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, have experienced in this country. Overall, the bell curve still looks pretty positive. I think the difference is that because of differing immigration laws in this country, you know, there were population quotas from specific countries from Asia that did not necessarily exist, from countries from Europe or from countries from South America. Different kind of populace came over here. When you have generally a culture that subscribes to Confucian kinds of philosophy, it's like, well, of course you're going to educate your kids, and of course you're going to work hard, and of course, you know, you're going to build success. Has anybody heard of the term tiger mom? Some of you might even have a tiger mom. It's like, you better study and you better play, you know, violin for 2 hours. And it's like, you're getting off easy because the kid next door has to play violin for 3 hours. It's a different kind of process. And because the marketing to this group did not come out of social services or civil rights, it really is a different kind of train that you need to think about. So I don't know if there's an explanation for the success rate in amongst Asian Americans relative to other ethnic groups, but certainly that's why my company and I never separate culture from business, in that I think you need to understand both, and you have to weave both of them together if you're going to be successful.
Well, coming from Hawaii, I was born in Japan, raised in Hawaii, but my parents are in their 80s, so it kind of gives me a different perspective on your kind of like your kind of point of view. I was kind of wondering what is your opinion on kind of using Hawaii as a test bed for marketing?
Hawaii is a whole different market, and if none of you have ever been to Hawaii, I recommend highly that you go there. It is as close to paradise on earth as I've ever seen in my life. The problem with Hawaii that's different than every other state in the United States, it has a majority Asian American population. And when I first got off the plane in Honolulu, I saw people who looked like me. It's like, whoa, I'm not in Chicago anymore. This is a very odd kind of feeling. So it's not a fair comparison to the general populace of the United States. If you look overall in the United States, 4, 5, 6% of the population versus 47, you know, 52% of the population in one area. It's great to try specific ethnic products to see how they test among ethnic groups. Not a fair comparison to the rest of the country. I mean, even something as little as soy sauce. Everybody knows what soy sauce is, right? In Hawaii, everyone, not just the Japanese Americans, but Japanese, Chinese, Koreans, everyone calls soy sauce by its Japanese name, shoyu. And you go, how did that happen? By having a majority population there. And you say that on mainland U.S., no one knows what you're talking about. So different kind of situation.
In the middle of the last century, European groups emigrated and assimilated very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then there was a backlash over the loss of the language. You've heard the adage, the grandson wants to remember what the father was taught to forget. Has there been any backlash with the Asian American groups over loss of language, or has there been loss of language?
Oh, there's absolutely been loss of language. Asian Americans lose language facility faster than any other ethnic group. We always say language is the first thing to go. Food is the last thing to go, but language is the first thing to go. Much of this is due to the fact that with Japanese Americans especially, because of the geopolitics of World War II, my parents, for example, said, you will not speak Japanese in this house. You will not speak Japanese outside the house. You know, we went through a bad experience that we don't want to reproduce. So if you want to succeed in this country, you are going to speak English. You are going to speak only English. So third generation Japanese Americans like me, none of them speak Japanese. So when I travel through Japan, people look at me like, what, are you stupid or what? You know, what do you mean you don't speak Japanese? I say, again, it's not genetic. You have to learn the language. I think part of the difference that we see with Asian Americans and everyone who's come from Europe is that because America for so long was a majority European-based culture, Asian Americans, African Americans, Hispanic Americans could not hide in terms of blending into the society, no matter the language facility, as easily as European groups. I mean, my family came here in 1917, but I still regularly get asked, you know, were you born here? Oh, your English is very good. It's like, it's because it's the only language I know. You know, how did you learn to speak so well? It's like, I went to college just like you. So it's a different kind of a situation. You know, my parents told me, you must be 200% American. Without ever understanding the very real fact that I would never be 100% American, because many people, especially with a European background, can walk through life daily, even African Americans now at this point, without any question, are you American? Are you a U.S. citizen? Were you born here? Are you part, you know, do you understand American culture? But many people from Asia, and many Asian Americans who've been here many generations, still can't. So a little bit different, but absolutely right.
Yeah. Hi, my question is that something I've noticed throughout my life, I kind of like buying luxury brands, and I tend to see this everywhere I go around the globe. I've been in Europe, U.S., and South America, and they all seem the same trend. I always see mm-hmm. Asian people, lots of them, in luxury brands. Is that like a cultural thing? Is that just coincidence I've had? Like, do they have a special propensity to buy luxury items? For example, I've been like to Gucci stores, lots of them. Rolex, lots of them.
Yeah.
Louis Vuitton, lots of them. So I just was wondering.
I think it's a little bit cultural. I mean, certain items have always carried certain status amongst different Asian countries, and it really wasn't dependent upon being Chinese or Japanese or Korean or what have you. What really sparked that was economic craziness. When the Japanese boom happened, you know, 30 years ago now, hopefully still struggling to recover from that, people lost their minds buying Rolex watches and Gucci purses and things like that. You see the same thing happening in China right now. There's a movie actually coming out based on a book called Crazy Rich Asians. And if you've ever been to Singapore or to places like that, unfortunately, a lot of the culture amongst the very wealthy has devolved into a very stereotypical American nouveau riche kind of way of thinking. It's like, yeah, we're going to buy all this stuff with all these labels on it. Does it last in the long term? Probably not. I think if you look at different societies, it's dependent upon what they saw in the product itself. I can't speak for all Asian countries, but particularly in Japan, one of the things that's been attractive about specific what we call luxury goods is the association with quality. And so that doesn't translate all the time, but in Japan, that was the main attraction.
Do you see any changes to marketing to Asian Americans 3.0 under a Trump presidency?
I was hoping nobody was going to ask you that. Yes and no. I think it's way too early to predict that. I think if all of the statements made during the presidential campaign are actually carried out, I think it's you're going to see several changes, not only for Asian Americans, but for everybody in the country. But again, I think it's way too early to figure all that out. You know, the dust is still settling. People are making new statements, retracting old statements, figuring out, you know, where things lie in the balance. I will say, though, that with all marketing, it should be constantly evolving and it should be constantly changing. So change is good. It just depends which direction, you know, we decide to go with that change.
My question was, how do you distinguish East Asian versus South Asian and Middle East Asian? How would you market to
them? A lot of that is based on self-identification, and that is really part of that. You know, in modern U.S., I can be 100% of something and 100% of another thing. It depends particularly on what group you talk to. Many Asian American organizations include geographic Asia. So China, Japan, Pacific Islanders, all of South Asia, including India, Pakistan, you know, the whole area. Generally, nobody gets as far as the Middle East because geographically, is that Asia? Yes. Culturally, is that Asia? No. I think, you know, with the Silk Road had to end someplace, and I think that ended with most of the Middle East. So if you look at certain types of ethnic philosophies, you can include most of Asia, including South Asia, that don't include most of Western Asia and the Middle East. So it really does depend. I mean, a lot of Indian Americans, for example, want to say, no, we are not part of Asia. I know just as many that say, no, we are part of Asia. So we need to be thought of that way. So it's really one of those personal choice kinds of things.
I think we're running out of time due to, one, the radio program being 1 hour, so we'd like to officially end this part of the discussion and give a warm thank you for Mr. Kamaki. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Robert Kamaki, principal of the Ronin Group and author of Many Cultures, One Market, A Guide to Understanding Opportunities in the Asian Pacific American Market. He spoke on the topic, Marketing to Asian America 3.0. This program, sponsored by the Asian World Center and the Hyder College of Business, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, November 30th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.